Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. This is part two of our coolest conversations that we did in honor of Taj Mahal and Rai Cooter Week in the Underground Garage, celebrating their artistry and the upcoming release of their album, Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee. In part one, I spoke with Rai Cooter, and here in part two, I'll be chatting with Taj Mahal. First, though, we'll reprise a portion of the song we went out with when I was speaking with Rai, his and Taj's version of the spiritual I Shall Not Be Moved. And that'll be followed by my interview with Taj Mahal on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved like a tree planted by the water.
We're back with a Mighty Manfred in the midst of a very special Coolest Conversations here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. We're capping off our Taj Mahal and Rai Cooter Week by speaking with both these exceptionally talented musicians and artists. We've already heard from Rai Cooter, and joining me now is musician, singer-songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Taj Mahal. Hello, Taj, how are you?
All right. Hey, how you doing, Maddie? What's going on?
Okay. I'm doing good, and I'm so excited to be able to share a few minutes here with you. Was wondering now, with the Omicron surge on the wane and many vaccinated, the pandemic seems to be receding in the U.S. Did you and your family weather the past 2 years okay? Did everybody?
Oh yeah, we did well. We held strictly to protocols, and we didn't lose any immediate family.
Oh man, I'm so happy to hear that. I was reading about your history, your family history, and finding out what a interesting musical background you had. And I was surprised that for a while, perhaps it was just a brief while, but there was a chance there would have been no Taj Mahal, and instead there would have been a Farmer Henry. Can you explain your background some and your passion for music versus maybe this passion for farming that you might have follow through with instead?
Well, I mean, there's no culture in the world that isn't based upon land and agriculture. And then connected to land and agriculture is man's interest in music and other things. But those things in my ancient culture on the continent of Africa, as well as, Central South America, the Caribbean, and the United States, it's based on land and agriculture. You just can't, there's nothing you're gonna do. You show me a person that could climb up an electric light pole and unscrew a bulb and come down the pole and go home and put some gravy on it and have it for dinner. And I'll show you some land and some beachfront land in Arizona.
Yeah, yeah.
So so my interest was, you know, it was like, okay, well, what are you going to do in this life? You know, I grew up in a very conscious Caribbean and Southern American, educated Southern American household. So people were talking about, well, what are you going to do with your life? You know, and we had great examples, both, you know, locally, you know, nationally and globally, you know, of what people were doing with their lives. And so I noticed that musicians, you know, farming was like, you know, something that I could always see music being a part of it. You know, I mean, whichever one, you know, started making things happen, that would be the one that I would, go with. But there would always be a component with music or a component with the agriculture, whichever one, you know. So I don't have a farm at the moment, but, you know, all you have to do is give me a moment or a neighbor or a friend who's like, you know, working their land or working their animals or, you know, doing that. And I'm, you know, I'm a part of it. I mean, I went to school for it and was educated, but all alongside of it, I was playing music, you know, because music and agriculture in terms of me, they go together. And so I don't see them as, you know, that's separate. I see them as in harmony with one another. I mean, some of the greatest songs that we have here are in the world, and particularly here in these United States, came from people working in agriculture, you know. So it's connected. But as far as what happened, I mean, in reality was that, you know, at that time, a young Black man just couldn't get the kind of loans that it would have taken to really be able to start out, you know, a farm of any kind or even a ranch. And we didn't have land. We didn't have anybody that was landed largely in our family. So, you know, it didn't happen that way. I mean, I'm sure there were probably some other alternatives that I didn't really, you know, investigate, or opportunities that I didn't ever investigate. But, you know, at that point, it was pretty obvious that, you know, that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, what am I going to do? Stand there and pout? No, that's like, okay, well, let's go in this direction. And, you know, I mean, it didn't make it any easier getting into the music business because I wanted to play real music. I mean, I thought it was real important. If they could take all this kind of like, I don't know, manufactured music and get people to be excited about it, well, I could, you know, if you had the proper circumstance and the music was powerful enough and you were convinced, had strong enough conviction, you could take any people, language challenged, and play the music, because the music goes in right there. I mean, it speaks to the soul, it speaks to the consciousness. And that's just basically what I set myself out to do. And also to show, you know, how the great gift that has come from the continent to Western, to, the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how much, I mean, every continent you look at, or, you know, every South America, Central America, the Caribbean, you know, the United States, you know, there's incredible music that's happening with the result of, you know, the coming of Africans into the Western world, you know, and by whatever way that we come in, you know, sometimes we come in on our own, you know, which is now being debated, but that's a horse for a different day.
Right.
But no, I mean, it's, and that, you know, because it has, now I'm connected to all of it. And so aren't we, you know, it's like, it's only, you know, the record industry, which goes like, okay, this one goes under that rock, and that one goes under this rock, and that one goes under that rock. You know, that people start seeing it that way, but it's connected, man. And so for me, if I hear somebody playing Batucada in Brazil, it's there. It's already speaking to me. It's not like, well, what are you saying? No, there's no question about it. You know, or just like when reggae came, you know, but I was preceded by a lot of stuff. You know, Calypso, Mento, you know, later on Soca, this one, that one, salsa, you know.
So let me interrupt for a second, because specifically in your household growing up, there was a lot of your parents and their musical backgrounds. Can you talk some about that and what you had present in the home growing up?
Well, my father was a classically trained Caribbean pianist, jazz pianist, mm-hmm. from his family was from St. Kitts and Nevis, and he grew up during the great jazz era. Born in 1915, he was 5 years old. By the time 1920s came, and at the end of it, he was 15. He had like 10 years when jazz was the dance music of America. My mother was born the same year. Yeah. They were actually a month and a day apart. Oh. One born in April in Aries, and the other one born in May, a Taurus. Uh-huh. And same age. And they both came up with, and she came up in the American, Southern gospel and more of that kind of, folkloric tradition from South Carolina. And then they came together in New York City. Her family immigrated and migrated to New York, and his family immigrated from the Caribbean to New York. And then they grew up during the 30s when all that great music was on, and met actually at the Savoy Ballroom.
Oh, wow.
During the opening gig of Ella Fitzgerald, when she was playing with the Chick Webb Band, and and she had that song, A Tisket, A Tasket. My mother went with a group of her girlfriends to go hear this new phenom that was all over the radio, and this great band. And my dad was there because he was a copyist and composer, and he'd done some copies, some charts for the band, and uh-huh. he was delivering the charts and hawking some of his tunes. He turned around and saw, a bevy of good-looking women, and went over, plied his trade, and here we are. I'm the harmonic from all that music. So, a little more of the story. My mother was a college graduate in 1938 from South Carolina State, in early childhood education, mm-hmm. and was also an incredible gospel and even to some extent light classical singer. But again, jazz was the music, and that was the communication. And in their talk about what they were going to do, my dad said he wanted to have a big family, and which they did do. And my mom said, well, yeah, okay, I'm cool on big family and all that, but are you interested? What do you think about a musician being able to try to, afford that kind of large family? He said, well, I'm game. We can do, we can negotiate here. And he said, well, look, here's the deal. She said, well, are you willing to take a day job or do whatever it takes to raise that big family, to support it? He said, yeah. He said, but here's the deal. He says, I want to have a piano in the house, and I want to have a radio record player and be able to collect the records along the way. He says, as long as I can hear the music and sit down and play it on the piano every now and then, and we can, get together with people socially to hear music, that'll be fine. And so that's the environment that I grew up with. Duke, Louis Jordan, Billy Eckstein, the Jimmy Lunsford, you name them, Ella, Billy Daniels, Andy Kirk, Mahalia Jackson, anybody you can think of that was really great musicians, we heard them in our household. And then, all this stuff too, like, hurt me, just it was just a lot going on. I don't think people really understood that a lot of people were living that way, particularly those who were connected to the Caribbean, because they had more of a global sense through the British Commonwealth, And so, then neighbors that were from the South and from the Caribbean and from all parts of Europe. And so it was a really great time to grow up. And then, little by little, the whole rock and roll craze came. But by the time rock and roll came, I'd already heard the imprint, that they were working from. So, I wasn't all that impressed with it. Every now and then somebody would impress me, because they were playing music in it. But other people were copying the copier who copied the copy. It was a law of diminishing returns. The farther away it got away from the original, the less of what you heard, So I knew what the originals sound like. And I was always happy about that. But I was exposed to Africans, Caribbeans, Latins, to me, it was all big family, big global family,
Your family, I read somewhere that you grew up, you mentioned your folks meeting in New York, but did you grow up in Springfield, Massachusetts?
Yeah, I was born in New York, and I was the only one of my family was born in Harlem. And by the time I was like 6 months old, that's when they moved me up to Springfield. And so I essentially grew up in that incredible environment.
So you grew up there. And then what prompts you to move west to Southern California, like in 1964, about 64? Why head out west?
Rye Cooter.
Well, how did you meet Rye? Did you already know him before you moved out there?
All of a sudden, the question mark goes up over the head in the bubble. I'm playing music. Playing music in different bands. I've been in doo-wop groups. I've been singing. I've been playing piano and tried to play piano and trombone and clarinet and a little bit of harmonica. And then the guitar came into my life after a tragedy, losing my dad and then my mother remarrying. My stepfather, unbeknownst to me, brought a guitar into the house during the years of guitar being, growing exponentially.
Right.
And, I got a guitar. The neighbors next door, friends of the family, their younger two brothers moved in from North Carolina. The oldest of the two younger ones was a guy named Lynn Perry, and he could really play. And I told him about my guitar, and I brought it out. He could really play. So he had a guitar, and I had a guitar, so I hung out with him. And then up the street from me was a family from Clarksdale, Mississippi. And they played the real Mr. Ernest Nichols and them. And Ernest was really good. He could play Boogie Chillin' just like John Lee Hooker.
Wow.
So, I used to go by there and hang out and wait till Ernest would get doing whatever he was doing. And he knew I was there. He said, I know why you're here. And I was patiently waiting. And he would retune that guitar and start playing it, and it's just like the record, And anyway, so there's that, an interest in Chuck Berry, maybe John Lee Hooker, little B.B. King, T-Bone Walker, Freddie King, those kind of guys, guitar players I heard. And then, guitar was all over the place. And so, little by little, I learned my little Jimmy Reed stuff, my little Muddy Waters, my little, this kind of music and that kind of music. And then, got a big wake-up call when I went to the University of Massachusetts. And by then, certain things were happening, because I was listening to the radio from back in the 40s.
Right.
Radio kid, all the way deep. I even built a crystal radio set.
Cool.
Home built completely by looking at something that was in the back of a cartoon magazine, what do we call funny papers, you know. So I'm listening, and I love to listen away late at night, because that's when you hear music that wasn't programmed. You know, like you hear it come up from like WDIA or CKY or WWBA, or even down as far as New Orleans.
Yeah.
You know, you hear somebody. And by the time I got to school, I could play a little guitar, play a little piano. I really could sing pretty good. And then all this, Kingston Trio, Harry Belafonte, the Terriers, the Weavers, the Brothers Swore, all this kind of interesting music started coming on. And this whole hippies, no, not even hippies, but the beatniks and the beats and all that, coming down the line, it was all familiar to me, but it really exploded when I went to the University of Massachusetts and found that all these people toured at these places. I had no idea that, Motown people toured at universities, and all that kind of stuff. But besides, there was all this folk music. And then furthermore, there were folk clubs and coffee houses, and people were listening to really deep, 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 deep catalog of music, way deep. I was like, what? Are you serious? Oh man, this is amazing. And then a lot of these players, Mississippi John Hurt and Elizabeth Cotton and Reverend Gary Davis and Sleepy John Estes and Booker White and Son House and you name them, they were starting to travel around to these concerts and whatnot. So I got really excited. So little by little, I started being, I don't know about making a name for myself, but being able to play at some of these clubs. Mm-hmm. And I got into playing up in Cambridge and Boston, the Turk's Head and Boston and Club 47 in Cambridge. And I was working MC for one of the Hoop Nanny nights. Mm-hmm. And a young guy came up and signed his name and told him that if he played, he got two songs to play. And if they like him, you can play a third one. And I noticed that he had a big Galliano 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what he was going to do, but he got up and played. And I noticed immediately his style of playing, his way he played the instrument, how he held the instrument, his whole approach to it was something that I had never seen before. And he played his two songs, and the audience responded really positively, nodded to him to play a third one. Then when he came off, I came and talked to him, said, man, where the heck did you learn how to play like that? He says, well, my uncle's Fred Gerlach. And Fred had recorded Folkways. Mm-hmm. And was a real good friend of Tiny Leadbetter, who was Leadbelly's niece. And he was really good. Very interesting man, by the way. Mm-hmm. Somebody people should take some time to find out about. But nonetheless, I started palling around with this guy, and we ended up having a duo. So he played pretty much on his 12-string. And then one point in time, he borrowed my guitar. I think he also might have had a Martin, But he started playing this music. And it's like, that stuff sounds like Blind Blake and Blind Boy Fuller. And Reverend Gary Davis, I said, man, where the heck you learn how to play like that? I'm listening to all the guys back east that are playing, supposedly playing this stuff. And this guy is playing. He says, well, I took some lessons from this guy in California. It's a young guy named Ryan Cooter. Oh, I said, where is he? Where can we? Where? If he can play that good, can we bring him out of here? He said, well, he's only 17 years old. 17 years old. Well, I guess we need to go out there, right? And we actually pulled it together. And I think Manny Greenhill booked us up in Maine and then over into Canada. And we played, I think, in Montreal. We played in Kennebunkport, and then we played in Montreal, and then we played in Toronto, and then went down to Detroit and played a gig down there, which was for a week. And then he had an uncle that lived there that was an optometrist that did, you know, did optometry for the some of the people in the Motown crew, you know, and artists. And he suggested that us not to hitchhike like our idea was. We were, you know, young and crazy. We're going to hitchhike out to California.
Yeah.
So he suggested a drive away, and we drove out to California. And the first thing I did was meet up with Ryan, and we sat down and played some music. Said, "Hey, man, you want to be in a group?" And we, with the help of McCabe's Guitar Store, Bob Baxter, and God, what's this guy's name? Okay, I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, they, Walter Camp, okay, and several other people, they had a booth at the Teenage Fair. And they needed somebody to demonstrate their guitars. And at that point, it was a Martin booth. And so we started like that. And little by little, we kept moving forward. Yeah. And no, Rye's a phenomenal musician. One of the best on the planet. You know. And,
so this is amazing to me because I haven't heard this before. So you meet this guy there on the East Coast. He's playing really well. And then he tells you that there's this kid, basically 17-year-old, that taught him how to play.
Yeah.
And wow, I wasn't aware of this. So you come out to the West Coast and you guys start playing together. And then that kind of morphs into the Rising Suns.
Right.
And you guys did release a single. And I know the unreleased stuff came out later. And then after that had ended, he played on a couple of your solo albums, some of your first albums.
He played on the first album. That was it.
He
played rhythm and lines on that guitar, on that album, and mandolin.
Yeah, he mentioned playing mandolin on some of the recordings on the Get On Board recording.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic mandolin.
Well, let me say this. So we've been celebrating you and Rye all this week in the Underground Garage, and the upcoming release of Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And that's due out April the 22nd. And
correct.
It features you and Rye doing songs that Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee did together during their many years of performing. So what was the catalyst that got you and Rye working together again?
I think part of it was we hadn't really seen each other for quite a long time. I think the last time I would bump into him periodically, like, you know, like 6 to 7 years would go by, he'd be unloading stuff or going somewhere, and we'd get a chance to say hello, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a busy life, and just like me, I'm busy. Yeah. You know, and we hadn't played any, though. And then a number of years ago, I got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Americana, you know, organization.
Yeah, and all right.
I went to Nashville to receive the award, to which Kevin Moe was the presenter.
Mm-hmm.
And before I went down there, they said, well, there's going to be a band with Ry Cooter, his son Joaquin,
mm-hmm,
on drums, Don was on bass, Buddy Miller on guitar, one other guy who's, I can't remember his name, on piano, and they want to know whether you'll do a tune that night. And so I'm thinking, okay, we're going down to Nashville. I'm going to play in the Ryman Auditorium, the Mother Church of Country Music. Now I think I'm playing something maybe that fit, befitting for the situation.
Right.
So I told Ryan, I said, well, I sent it back and said, well, what about the song I've written called Loving in My Baby's Eyes? And he listened to it. He said it's a really good song. He says, but I prefer to stomp them down. So I knew that stomp them down is State Barrel of Blues. States for a blues.
Yeah.
So that's what we ended up playing.
Cool.
And it was a really good night. There was a lot of nice people there. You know, I mean, we really had just a wonderful night. I think that kind of like connected up. And then little by little, I checked him on his birthday. Mm-hmm. And, and then we started a little bit sending, you know, different kinds of music back and forth that we liked.
Mm-hmm.
Not always. It was, you know, sporadic. And at some point I just, you know, threw a line out there and said, hey, man, we ought to do something together, you know, and said, well, what about coming down to L.A.? And I got on the train, brought three instruments with me, four instruments down there, and hung out. We played a little bit. Then COVID came and that like changed up everything.
Right.
But then, you know, that still kept the spark there. And I guess, as he said, his son, Joaquin, said, hey, you know, I think it's something you should do. And he says, he always listens to Joaquin. So, you know, the next thing I know, it's getting serious, you know. There are dates for us to come down and play. And then the thing that I always like that I really like about Riot is that it's going to be a situation. It was really great. We recorded in his son's home in Altadena in the living room, you know, and I mean, set up basically, you know, put together studio, you know, the recording. Mm-hmm. And it was just great, wonderful, relaxed, you know. It's like two guys playing in the living room, playing on the front porch, playing on the back porch, you know, raw, you know, ragged but right, you know.
Ragged but right.
You know,
why the focus on Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee material?
Well, what a great trio, man. I mean, you know, if you were a youngster coming along, you saw these two guys, you know, they really came out in the past. Who else was playing like that at that time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were lucky because we were around the club. Well, I came into the club when I came out to California.
Yeah.
But I saw all these folk clubs where these guys were playing, you know? I mean, you know, you go and it's like, you know, the guy that wrote Walk Right In, Gus Cannon, he's in New York, Memphis Willie B, you know? I mean, Sunhouse hanging out, playing music with Sunhouse. Are you kidding me? I mean, it don't get no better than that, you know? And I mean, who are those guys? Those guys aren't around anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they had incredible, careers on record and largely went unsung outside of, two or 3,000 records sold globally, you know? And, you know, but they were incredible musicians and we were fortunate enough to find, you know, find our way to them or them find their way to us, you know.
So for Ry Cooter, he had said that he became aware of those guys with this 10-inch album.
Yeah.
Yeah. On board. Do you recall when you first heard their music?
Yeah, I probably heard them here and there and wondered who the heck were they?
Yeah.
But because you didn't hear it. But once I got, as I said, once I got going to the university, you know, you could go into a store and pick up the latest, you know, Mississippi John Hurt record or Elizabeth Cotton record. You know, my favorite album from that time was an album called Sonny is King. I think it's on the Folkways label. Man, it was just so good. You know, and then I learned about these other, I mean, when I was living in Springfield, I would say because of the demographic of you know, the African-American people that were there,
yeah.
You know, the marketing was set up a certain kind of way. So you would hear Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, but you would not hear Brownie McGhee and Sonny Terry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wouldn't hear Lightning Hopkins. You would not hear Sleepy John Estes.
Yeah.
You know, now, if you dug deep enough around, there are probably some guys around, some oddballs who we collected some Lead Belly records.
And, yeah.
You know, in fact, when I was working on the dairy farm, you know, there was a guy that came to test the milk, and he talked to me all the time about Clint. He was a bachelor named Pete. I don't know what his last name is, mm-hmm. but he'd always talk about he collected Lead Belly records. I was like, collected records? Well, I mean, we record collection because you like to play the stuff that people came over to listen and dance to, right. but the whole collecting of records was a new idea for me. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, I started running into, you know, different kinds of anomalies that were different from being marketed to, you know, in an urban area, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's think here for a second. You were talking about recording there in Joaquin's house in the living room. And my understanding is that you came up with you guys figured out a bunch of songs and what you would do, and you ran through them, and the ones that kind of turned out the best, that comprised the album. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, pretty yeah. much so.
Well, was there any song that you thought, you know, this would be great, and it just really didn't turn out? Was there any big disappointment in the songs? Was there
something? No. There were some surprises, though. The Joaquin's wife, I think it's Juliet. She's a classical pianist, yeah. and had a beautiful grand piano sitting there. So at some point, they were working on something, and I sat down and started playing on the piano. And Rye comes out and says, "Oh my God, that's," and starts singing the lyrics to a Deep Sea Diver.
Yeah.
You know, and we just, that's how we cut it, just like that. You know, I mean, you know, and I'm, you know, clams and everything, you know, just, this is what music is all about, man, is having fun, playing it in the moment, you know. Like, again, who's playing?
Well, let me ask you about that song, because like the Brownie McGee's version of that, he's playing guitar. Why did you think to do it on the piano?
No, I was playing the piano and Rye started singing.
Oh, right. I got you.
I was just enjoying, yeah. I was just having a piano moment. Yeah. You know, it's like, wow, this is good piano. Let me see how it sounds. Oh my God, it sounds so good. I started playing, and the next thing I know, he's singing, and we started over again, and boom, we got it.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great one on there. You know, let's talk for a moment longer about Joaquin, because I was going to ask you about their father-son dynamic, because he's done a lot of work with his dad, and you were mentioning that he's always asking for Joaquin's opinion, or trusts his opinion.
Mm-hmm. He trusts his opinion, yeah.
And what was the dynamic between them overall? There's a lot of consulting between the two going on back and forth, or?
Well, I really, the dynamic is good, really great. Yeah, they just communicate a lot of times silently, you mm-hmm. know, not a whole lot of talking, you know, but they, you know, he's been communicating with his dad a long time like that.
Well, right.
So, it's real good, you know, and I mean, you know, we certainly have conversations, but it isn't like debate. It isn't like that at all. It's always very good. And he just, you know, I mean, and yeah, I mean, both of them compliment each other if there's if something that's happening.
Did you meet Joaquin when he was younger?
No, I did not meet him. Oh, I think the first time I met him, he was pretty much a grown man.
Yeah.
I think I saw him in the when they were riding on the motorcycle in Cuba.
Yeah.
He did the, you know, Buena Vista.
Buena Vista. Right, right.
Yeah, that was when I finally got a good look at him. And then when I went down to play with him, when we first started, you know, setting up for this album, seeing if we really had, you know, something that we could do together, you know, stay, you know, are we going to be able to play together, or are we going to step on each other's toes? Mm-hmm. And no problem with that. So, yeah, then I met him, and then Joaquin, and then I met his family, you know, and so that was real nice. And then he lived, at that time, Ryan was still living in Santa Monica.
Right.
And he was looking to move, acquired a place, and Joaquin had moved over to Altadena and was telling his dad, hey, maybe you need to move over here. And so finally both of them are over there, but he's over there. What a lovely house. You know, really.
It's very, very nice up in Altadena. I live in the son of Mount Washington, Cypress Park.
Oh, yeah.
Here in L.A. So, yeah, Altadena is just up the road a little bit from me. Yeah. A good friend of mine lives there in Altadena.
Yeah.
Our coolest song in the world this week is Hooray, Hooray.
Yeah.
And I found this online. I found a version of the song from like 53, and it's credited to Sonny Terry. And man, it's like a really rocking arrangement, electric guitar, piano, and drums. And I know that with Brownie, they did the he did a song later, so an acoustic accompaniment. But that 53 version, really rocking. You guys do the song. Were you aware of this this really rocked up version? And did that affect?
No, I never listened to it. I only heard them do that kind of stuff live with the two of them with acoustic guitar. Yeah. That's the only way I heard them. I heard some of Brownie's songs, like, you know, did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? You know, that's pretty good. You know, a bunch of stuff. You know, Brownie was trying to get in there. You know, he had a brother named Stick McGee. Stick was the one to come up with Why and Spodeyote.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that in a moment. But first, I wanted to ask you about Picabella Cotton. Mm-hmm. When I was in elementary school, we had music class twice a week, and we sang folk songs like Froggy Went to Court and then Jimmy Crack Corn and Picabella Cotton. And now Jimmy Crack Corn is kind of funny when I think about that line, pass the bottle and he got dry, you know, these little kids singing about passing the bottle there. But so Picabella Cotton, Sonny and Brownie, they do that. Sonny also recorded a version with like Woody Guthrie.
Right.
How does that song resonate to you, with you, and why did you guys decide to do a version of it?
Great song, great rhythms, you know, it really is. That's it. I mean, really, we everything is about the song and the story.
Yeah.
If there ain't no story, ain't no song, we don't do it.
Was there any song afterwards? After you finished recording everything and, you know, you head back home, did you think of a tune that maybe you should have done, that maybe you'll do in the future?
Like, no, not so much that way. Yeah, we've definitely come up with material that the both of us will play, you know, as this thing unfolds.
Okay.
You know? Oh, yeah. It's not going to be like, you know, the rock band records their new album and goes out on the road and only plays the songs off of it. We're really thrilled with the opportunity to really be able to be out there playing this music and have an audience. I mean, the first two gigs that we had, the 19th and 20th of
May, right?
Of May, sold out immediately. Boom, gone. You know, and so that's a testament to the fact that the music still has a lot of power and people are still excited about it.
Well, now my understanding is if that goes well, that you'll consider to do other shows as well?
Correct.
Oh, terrific. Well, I got my fingers crossed. If it's already sold out, you know, you guys are already working together again. I'm hoping that there'll be a lot more shows to follow.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, we're feeling it. And
And you only travel by train, is that right?
No, I travel. I'll travel all the other ways to get around, but if I have the option and the time, mm-hmm. I travel by train. Yeah, I for years, you know, I traveled. I flew. You know, I'd wake up in the morning wherever I was living, and fly either home or to wherever I was going. You know, where I was living. And so, I mean, some mornings I'd wake up, head to the airport, and when I got off the plane, I'm in London. You know, or I'm in, you know, West Africa, South America, you know, or Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Hawaii, or Toronto, or, you know, whatever, Glasgow, or, you know, someplace, Barcelona, you know, Paris, Madrid.
A lot of traveling. Another track on the album there, Cornbread Peas and Black Molasses. Do you personally have anything against cornbread?
No.
Should it be sweet or not?
Slightly. Because if they make it too sweet, it's corn cake.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was. Yeah, that's like having dessert with my dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there are a couple of spiritual numbers on Get On Board. And you mentioned your mom, you know, coming from that gospel tradition background.
Yeah.
You include What a Beautiful City and I Shall Not Be Moved. And we mm-hmm. took a listen to I Shall Not Be Moved just before we started chatting. How important was it for you to have a couple of spirituals on the album?
These came as Rye's suggestion, and but part of it is that both of us like that great quartet singing from back in the day. You know, I grew up with all of that. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Sunday morning, you know, we're waking up to the smell of food cooking in the kitchen and the gospel music being on the record player, because Sunday was mom's day and you didn't go near the record player because she all day long until about 4:30. And then when she let off, you didn't go near it until maybe 6 or 7 o'clock. And then you might be able to play something different. Mm-hmm. But that was her day. So yeah, I mean, and I was just used to the sound of the music, you know, and these songs are just really fantastic. They're great. And Reverend Gary Davis, you know, for the guitar end of it. And then all these other incredible, you know, gospel quartets. And, you know, I mean, I don't think the majority of Americans really know how much gospel music was really recorded. Tremendous amount, some of it was it was lucrative enough for them to record those people, and people bought those records.
Well, we're going to take a listen to Drinking Wine Spodiote in a moment here, and as you mentioned, Brownie McGee's younger brother Styx did it first, and for him it was like a hit on Atlantic Records back in like 1949.
Oh, yeah. Right. I remember singing it as a kid.
Oh, really? What's funny, I mentioned or asked Rye about it, and he said he first came across the song on this Atlantic Records compilation. So I was going to ask you how you came across the song, but you were already singing it, right?
Oh, yeah. Cool. In fact, the grown people used to come up to you and say, well, what's going on, Spodiote? Yeah, right.
Well, I love how you slipped a Boone's Farm into the lyrics. Have you ever had any elderberry or blackberry wine?
Oh yeah, I did. I did my sweet wine.
I can't imagine that Boone's Farm holds up pretty well against that, or does it?
No. I don't be bothered with that. I've graduated, you know, to Gewurztraminer, you know, and Haute Sauterne, there's some wonderful ones from France, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
You become more refined in your wines.
Yeah, become refined just like the wine. Yeah.
Well, Taj, thank you so much for helping make today's Coolest Conversations such a special one.
Well, my pleasure, man. I really appreciate it, man, because, you know, it's been a nice long road to have this music be, you know, enjoyed and listened to and respected for its contribution to our, you know, the greater happinesses of this planet and in our lives.
Well, it's time for me to serve up another track off of Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and we'll be drinking wine Spodiote now with Taj Mahal and Rye Cooter and Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Oh, yeah.
California, everything is fine. All them cats that be drinking that wine, drinking that mess, it's their delight. And when they get to drinking, it's hard to sing all night. Drinking wine, sporty oldie, drinking wine. Drinking wine, sporty oldie, drinking wine. Drinking wine, sporty oldie, drinking wine. Mama, drinking wine, that bottle of me. Drinking that mess is their delight. And when they get to drinking, they start to fight all night. Knocking out the windows, busting out the doors. Drinking no more, but they want some more. Drinking wine, spooky oldie, drinking wine, mama. Drinking wine, spooky oldie, drinking wine, mama. Drinking wine, spooky oldie.
That was just a snifter of Drinking Wine, Spooky Oldie here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Track is off the upcoming Taj Mahal and Rye Cooter album, Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. This is the Mighty Manfred, and many thanks again to Taj Mahal for making this Coolest Conversation so special. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, I'll be joined by Brad Shepherd of the Hoodoo Gurus. They have a new album out called Chariot of the Gods, and we'll find out all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.